from the UC Davis Superfund group, and so I'll let you do more of that. So let's give them a warm welcome as well.
Thank you all. Thank you for letting us come today. So I am Candace Beaver, and I am the Resource Translation Coordinator for the Superfund program, which basically means that my goal is to bring science to the community. That's what we're doing tonight. And so I'm also a postdoc researcher, so you'll hear about my research as well and what I've been doing in the lab. But the Superfund program, you're probably familiar with EPA Superfund sites, which are hazardous waste sites. What we do is we research the Superfund chemicals and the hazards that they pose to human health. So that's the link of our program, and what all of our talks will discuss today are essentially Superfund or hazardous chemicals and their influence on human health. And with that, we have Amy Rand. You can introduce yourself as well, too.
Okay. All right. Hi, I'm Amy. I just started my postdoc here at UC Davis, and it's only been about 2 months, so I don't have anything really to explain from what I'm currently doing. But I decided to come here tonight and talk to you a little bit what I've done for my PhD research, which took place at the University of Toronto in Ontario. So this is what brings me here tonight. I want to, let's introduce
one more. The second speaker for tonight.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Brennan. I'm a graduate student at UC Davis in the Agricultural and Environmental Chemistry graduate group from Michael Dennison's laboratory, and I'll be speaking tonight about endocrine disruption and some of the assays we use in our lab to detect endocrine disrupting compounds.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about what I've been doing for my PhD projects, which really looked at a group of chemicals that were, when you think about it, relatively constantly exposed to. And what I particularly focused on was how these chemicals break down within us and what the consequence was of this breakdown process. So when we think about processes that break down chemicals, what I'm really referring to is biological metabolism. And regardless of whatever we're exposed to, whether it be environmental contaminants, whether it be drugs, or even the food that we consume, we pretty much, everything really undergoes this metabolic process. So an example of this is with acetaminophen, which is the active ingredient in Tylenol. It acts within us to relieve pain and fever for about 4 hours, after which the symptom, or however it acts, it subsides. And part of the reason for why it subsides is because this acetaminophen, or the active compound, starts breaking down within us. And what I mean by breaking down is that it gradually changes its structure from this alcohol group to these other groups here, where oxygen is being added to the chemical. And when we add oxygen, we're making it more water soluble, and therefore it's going to be quickly eliminated from our bodies within a good amount of time. Now, with that in mind, the chemicals that I focused on are these fluorotelomer-based compounds. And these compounds are really defined based on their chemical architecture. They have a long fluorinated tail, which in this case is 8 carbons long. And they have a functional head group, which can change depending on its consumer application. And this functional head group and perfluorinated tail are connected by 2 hydrogenated carbons. So this forms the basis for all of the other chemicals that are out there when it comes to fluorinated chemicals. So 2 of the main chemicals that are out there are the 8,2 fluorotelomer alcohol, or FTO for short, and also the disubstituted polyfluoroalkyl phosphates, or let's simplify this, the DIPAPs. So the fluorotelomer alcohols are used as building blocks to manufacture higher weight fluorinated polymers. And these polymers have a wide range of applications. They're put on our cookware to make them non-stick, like Teflon. They are used to coat our clothing to make them waterproof. And they're also used to coat indoor furniture and carpets to prevent grease from building up and to prevent them from leaching water and letting them grow moldy over time. The DyePaps have similar applications, but they're often used to coat things like fast food paper packaging materials, like popcorn bags. And once these chemicals are coated on these materials, it allows them to be water resistant and grease resistant so that the greasy fast food won't be able to leach through the paper materials. So the process used to make these EFTO compounds and DyePaps is not a perfect process. While the processes have been optimized to produce the 8-2 and the 6-2 DyePaps, the eventual consumer products will have a range of different fluorinated chain lengths, from very short chain lengths to very long ones. And recently, there's been a few studies that have showed that when we're exposed to these materials, like say from a popcorn bag, we ingest small amounts of these DyePaps or EFTOs. And once we expose ourselves to these chemicals, the chemicals then end up within our blood. And there's been a few studies recently that have shown that we have a range of DyePap chemicals from this imperfect process that ends up in our blood, and it's within our blood from people all across North America. So what's the consequence of this? Once DyePaps are released from the commercial products, or say the EFTOs off-gas from our carpets and we inhale them, what happens to them then? Well, these parent compounds can then undergo metabolism. They can break down within our bodies to form other products like PFCAs, or perfluorinated carboxylic acids. And these PFCAs are also present within our blood at very low concentrations. So there's been a lot of research and regulatory attention focused primarily on these PFCAs. They're considered a global environmental issue. They are present within ocean waters, within lakes. They're found as far up as the Arctic. They bioaccumulate within wildlife. And of course, they're also present within us, no matter where you are across the globe. The poster board PFCA, some of you may have heard of this, is PFOA, the C8 version. And PFOA has been known to bioaccumulate within us. And the thing about PFOA, or anything that has a fluorinated chain that's longer than 8 carbons, is that it persists within us. PFOA has a half-life within us of about 5 years, meaning that it doesn't go anywhere for a decade, 10 years. It doesn't leave our bodies. So as a result of the persistence of some of these PFCAs, there's been so much attention that has been garnered around studying the toxicity of these compounds. Lots of animal studies have been done where at high concentrations, these PFCAs have been shown to form liver tumors within rats and also have some degree of developmental effects. The concentrations used for these animal studies are very high, and so it's still uncertain what the effect of these PFCAs would have when it comes to their presence within us. But in addition, not only do we have these PFCA compounds, we also have these other metabolites that form along the way as these parent compounds break down to form PFCAs. And while PFCAs have received so much attention, these other metabolites have received little to no attention. So that's really the focus of my research. I really wanted to explore the consequence of our exposure to these other metabolites. So as an example, let's take our ectoparent compound and we're going to break it down. So we have our three PFCAs that form as a result of this breakdown process. And we also have a few other metabolites. We have the fluorinated aldehydes, and we also have the fluorinated carboxylic acids. Not only do these intermediate metabolites form PFCAs, but there's another pathway that has gone really unexplored. And this is this pathway here, which is where this aldehyde reacts with glutathione to produce this glutathione conjugate. Now, glutathione is a natural antioxidant present within us at very high concentrations, and its natural role is to protect us from metabolites like this. So this is a detoxifying mechanism where it binds to the aldehyde, and when it binds to this aldehyde, it makes it, again, more water-soluble and readily eliminated from our bodies. So just like the fluorinated aldehyde, acetaminophen, if we go back to that example, it also metabolizes to form a metabolite that can readily react with glutathione. But the thing about glutathione is that you have, it does show some sort of reactivity of these metabolites. Now, with acetaminophen, if you take it at doses higher than about 4 grams, acetaminophen turns quite toxic, and lots of liver toxicity can occur. And part of the reason for that toxicity is because you're no longer reacting it with only glutathione, but you're also reacting it with other things in our body, like proteins, that aren't part of our natural defense system. So when this happens, you're changing the structure of the protein, you're causing it to be unable to do its normal function, and therefore toxicity could happen from this mechanism. So what I wanted to ask was, since we're getting reactivity with glutathione, what's the potential for this aldehyde to react with proteins to give us protein addicts? And how toxic would these protein addicts be? So to understand the reactivity of these aldehydes with the proteins, I used a technique known as mass spectrometry. And it's a really great technique because it allows us to ask and answer what the exact mass or weight of this protein is. So here is the signals arising from the mass of the protein. When we incubate it with the aldehyde, we're seeing these other signals coming in, and that's corresponding to the aldehyde being added to the protein. Therefore, we're increasing the mass of that protein, and we're getting these new signals coming out. Now, as we increase the concentration of that aldehyde, we're seeing an increase in the signal of that adducted protein. So this study was the first to show that these aldehydes not only react with glutathione, but they also react with proteins. Now, what's the toxicity that happens from this whole process? So the next study that I did was to really understand the toxicity of these aldehydes and compare that toxicity with the PFCAs that have been heavily studied and scrutinized, compared it with all different sorts of aldehydes having varying fluorinated chain lengths, and also compared that toxicity with the other acid intermediates. Now, to do this study, I used a cell line, which Jennifer is going to be talking about very soon. The cell line in particular were these human liver epithelial cells, just because it was human-based and really relevant for this study. And so after incubating each PFCA or acid or aldehyde intermediate within the cells, I waited for about 24 hours, and then I added a dye. And the dye bound to any living parts of the cell that were still around, giving off this really intense red color. So the more amount of living cells in the system, the more red it was. And as we increased the toxicity, the more cells we were killing, and therefore the less red it was, the more clear it was. But we couldn't just do this study by looking at the color changes. We had to actually quantify or measure the amount of toxicity. And we did that by understanding the concentration needed to bring the amount of cells down or kill the amount of cells by 50% or half. So once we did that, we could get a really good sense of the relative toxicity between all of these intermediate metabolites. And you can see already that there's a very good trend here between chain length and toxicity, where the higher the chain length, the greater the toxicity compared to these lower shorter chain lengths, PFCAs and acids. Now, we can zoom in more and extract more information out of the study by looking at all of the metabolites that have the same fluorinated chain length. And here we have our aldehydes, and you can see from this graph that the aldehydes were much more toxic than this PFCA or the acid intermediates. In fact, the aldehydes were about 100 times more toxic than when you compare it to the corresponding PFCA. So we can say from this, and this is just a preliminary study, but it's the first time where anyone's actually been able to show that these aldehyde metabolites yield greater toxicity than the PFCAs, perhaps due to their reactivity with the proteins that are within those cells. So I think the take-home message from this is that we can't just look at these parent compounds that we may be constantly exposed to. It's really important to look at the other breakdown products that we have along the way. There's been lots of studies that have looked at these PFCAs from a toxicity standpoint, but it's not just about looking at these PFCAs which persist within us. It's also about looking at these other metabolites, and it's not until we really get a full sense of the PFCAs and the aldehydes when we can truly make a great assessment about the risk that these chemicals have to our daily lives. So with that, I would just like to acknowledge the following people, mainly at the University of Toronto and a group of people at Duke University who I did the cellular project with, and also this research center, and for all of you, what a great audience and a large audience. Thanks so much for coming. And I'll take any questions.
So it can resist glutathione. It's what mechanism does it use? What chemical mechanism does it use to resist glutathione to be expelled from the body?
Right. So glutathione is a great antioxidant, mm-hmm. but it only can target chemicals that have a specific structure. So in the case of the aldehydes have a specific center within a structure that the glutathione can attack. But unfortunately for PFCAs, the structure of these PFCAs make it so that glutathione cannot react to it, which is part of the reason why it's so difficult to eliminate PFCAs. Our natural molecules within us, they can only do so much to bind and conjugate with our metabolites. But then you get to a point where some molecules are unable to be reactive to any of our defense system, and therefore they live and persist within us for a great amount of time. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Oh, sorry. I'm going to find available through health food stores. Are there any other similar substances we can ingest to help with the toxicity?
That's a good question. I think that, glutathione is great, and our body has lots and lots of it. So I think right now it's hard to understand exactly what we need to take, if anything at all, in order to help remedy this, because there's lots of different modes of toxicity that we have to understand first before we can get a true appreciation about how to deal with these chemicals.
Glutathione is available intravenously. There are some doctors that practice heavy metal detoxification that can infuse it intravenously. My question is, how do you measure these organic toxins in the human body? How do I know I'm toxic?
Oh, I see. I think that's something that takes years and years to optimize. And I think with the cell lines and with the amino acids that Candy's going to talk about too, is part of the tools that help us recognize what chemicals are in our bodies. And how we can understand all of the unknown chemicals that are within us. For this study in particular, we already knew what chemicals were in our body and could then measure using these tools, like analytical mass spectrometry tools, to help us target whatever's in our body.
But this is not available to the general public?
Usually not, although some of the tools we are developing have been licensed and can be. The goal of a lot of our work is to actually make it available as a on-the-shelf test, an over-the-counter test that you can take. But a lot of them for the organic compounds are not there yet. But to also answer your other question, the concentrations that are in our body, we don't know yet if they are, what level they are toxic. But also, we're inundated with so many compounds and so many different things, and how are those interacting, we're not sure. And science isn't there yet to say, because we can't test on humans and dose somebody, so the best we can do is test with cell lines or test with animal studies. And generally, that's limited to one target and how much one compound and what is the maybe death, maybe cancer. Those are endpoints that are hard to quantify. So we can't, we can measure the compounds, but we don't know how much is actually toxic.
Right.
First of all, I think Madame Curie tested on herself. And she tested, she died of bottom line is, from just waiting in microwave popcorn.
So I use microwave popcorn as an example. They're certainly present within microwave popcorn, but I think if we only focus on microwave popcorn, it's not the only thing contributing to this. There's many other mechanisms for how we're being exposed. So I love microwave popcorn. I don't know if it's happy to get. I'll take the risk. I think the concentrations that we get from popcorn are so low that we have to think about all of the other sources of exposure first before we all
So we won't call you Madame Curie then?
maybe 20 years later.
But what other products of microwave popcorn have this chemical on them?
Most of them, yes. Although now,
What are the products other than microwave popcorn? Like, is it on potato chips or?
This study, I think, maybe just came out, and we've shown that Subway cookie wrappers have dye caps in particular. But fluorinated polymers are all around. I'm sure they're on the cushions that you're sitting on and within your carpets. There's really not a lot we can do unless we're living in the backwoods.
Let's take one more, and then we'll do the next talk so that we can also have questions at the end.
I have a much more general question. So you guys are basically under this Superfund. You're with UC Davis Superfund Research Program, which is, I understand, 14 or something universities are involved in this. Are you limited by the Superfund, the chemicals that were left over by the Superfund sites to what you can study, or are you free to study chemicals in the environment?
Okay.
Very general question, but yeah. I didn't know that there was Superfund money left.
There is.
I understand it is.
So technically, we are funded by National Institutes of Health.
Okay.
So we are not on the EPA side, we're on the NIH side.
Okay.
And technically under that is National Institutes of Environmental Health Safety. So we actually have, that's where our money comes from. And their interest is solely human health. It started out as hazardous chemicals from Superfund sites, and we are developing remediation strategies as well. But we're not limited to those chemicals. It's any chemical that has a human health impact.
Fabulous.
So that's as broad as, so that's why
Chiboa's
been.
Yeah.
Okay, so she can take more questions as well. But thank you.
Okay, so Amy left off with one of the cell lines she looked at for her Pifoas and compounds. So what I wanted to talk about, I didn't want to jump right into the assays our laboratory uses to detect endocrine disrupting compounds. I wanted to more talk about endocrine disruption broadly. So everyone here has heard of Rachel Carson, I'm assuming, wrote Silent Spring, and which was a groundbreaking book for toxicology, especially environmental toxicology, presence of DDT being released in mass quantities in the environment. Raptors of fish, in particular, had eggshell thinning, and so there was a lot of concern about what we're putting out in the environment and how it impacts wildlife, as well as potential effects on humans through environmental exposure. So she did not coin endocrine disruption, but she really started the idea of environmental toxicology. So endocrine disruption, briefly, are compounds in the environment, whether natural or man-made, that got released inappropriately into the environment that affect our endocrine system. Traditionally, this has been thought of as estrogen-related or androgen-related, although EPA has now expanded its definition to thyroid. We're now finding that there are a bunch of hormones that regulate our endocrine system, and that so this field's really broadening. Who in the wildlife kingdom system is most affected are, unfortunately, the animals that are most exposed. So a lot of these compounds are in our water systems, and so fish, amphibians, aquatic reptilia, seabirds, raptors, again, of fish, because some of these compounds bioaccumulate. And particularly, stage of life is very important. So I have down here fish eggs and frog eggs. And exposure at these prenatal times can lead in devastating effects on the reproductive system later in life. Exposure at certain times when you're not supposed to be making these hormones can disrupt reproduction down the road.
Oh no!
Too bad, Kermit. But so what are the effects that have been noted in these wildlife populations that have been exposed to endocrine disrupting compounds? We're seeing altered male to female ratio in the egg hatches, so we might see an increase now in females over males over what was previously seen. Underdeveloped sex organs or non-functional sex organs, also presence of both sex organs on the same organism, particularly in fish and frogs. Altered behavior later in life, sterility and infertility, both in females and males, and decreased hatch rate. And some of these effects of endocrine disrupting compounds have really caused some marital problems down in the alligator population in Florida. I don't know if, has anyone here heard of Theo Colburn? Well, she's been called the Rachel Carson of the 1990s, and she really coined endocrine disruption and was very passionate. Still, I don't know if she's alive, but that's horrible. really got the whole endocrine disruption, its effects on wildlife movement going. So Lake Apopka is the third largest lake in Florida. And in July of 1980, Tower Chemical Company improperly disposed of a large quantity of DDE, which is a breakdown product of DDT, into the environment, which unfortunately got into Lake Apopka. And when Theo Colburn and her group went in and looked at alligator populations in this lake, they found that the males had significantly shrunken penises compared to other alligators in the non-exposed areas. Mysteriously, Tower Chemical Company closed its doors 6 months after that spill. So I don't know. But so we know it's very clear with wildlife that exposure to certain compounds that can either act as estrogens or androgens, or knock down the effect of estrogens or androgens, can have certain effects. What are the facts relevant to the human population? Now, I'm not saying that these facts up here are caused by exposure to endocrine disrupting compounds. This is very hotly contested. However, what is up here correlates with what has been seen in wildlife populations and has been shown in laboratory studies when studying endocrine disrupting compounds. So we're seeing a rise in reproductive infertility problems, both in men and women. Women are having more problems carrying baby to term, decreased sperm counts for men. Again, this could be just better reporting, right, than was previous decades. Breast and prostate cancers, many of which of both types are hormone driven, are the second most lethal cancer in the US for women and men respectively. And the age of puberty in females is seen now as early as 7 years old, which is a marked decrease from 10 to 30 years ago.
Where was it 10 to 30 years ago, and what is it realistically now among school children?
I believe this puberty report came out in 2010, so I would think it'd be similar to what was in 2010. 10 to 30 years ago, I don't have a number off the top of my head, but I know it was not. This particular study looked at 6, 7, and 8 year olds, and I don't think it was that low in the previous studies. The reason this is a concern is that the earlier a girl hits puberty, the greater her chances of breast cancer later in life. So now again, not saying this is all from endocrine disrupting compounds, but it links up to what is seen in wildlife and in laboratory studies. Certainly with humans, again, as Amy mentioned, we're very complicated, we're exposed to a lot more things, a lot of social factors also could be at play. So because of what we've seen in wildlife populations, and there's concern of the effects of endocrine disrupting compounds on humans, our laboratory likes to, there's a call for monitoring these compounds in the environment, as well as our personal care products. Certainly there have been some personal care products with endocrine disrupting compounds. Bisphenol A, right? Very hotly contested also. I believe it's banned in Canada now in infant products like baby bottles and whatnot. So that's a weak estrogen, although there's apparently other pathways it can act through than your classical estrogen mechanism. And so our lab develops assays for detecting endocrine disrupting compounds, compounds which can either act like hormones or knock down the action of hormones. So how do most of the hormones in our bioassays work, or in our bodies work? They work through hormone receptors. Briefly, I just wanted to go over how a hormone works. So we have our compound here, I'm gonna call this a ligand, coming in, binding to our hormone receptor. Once the ligand's bound to the hormone receptor then goes to a particular sequence on the DNA that it recognizes. This is called its reporter element. Once this binding has occurred on the DNA at the reporter element, it turns on a particular set of genes associated with binding to that reporter element, and you get activation of genes, ultimately leading in protein expression. So what if we could somehow manipulate that mechanism of receptor coming in and binding to its reporter element, activating genes? What if we could take a particular gene that's very easy to quantify and link it right up to that reporter element? So that's what we do in our laboratory. We have two main genes we use, and we call these reporter genes. So we have our, I believe I misspoke. I keep calling this a reporter element, it's the response element. So we have the response element here, the particular sequence on the DNA where the receptor binds once it's bound to ligand, linked up next to our reporter gene. And we use two in our laboratory. One is from firefly, it's the luciferase gene. It's the gene that actually makes the protein that makes the firefly glow, right? So we're gonna be reading light levels here. The other one we use is very similar. It's from jellyfish, green fluorescent protein. They've actually put that protein into rabbits and turned off the lights, and you can, it's very weird. Yeah, so that's actually how our cells work too. You can just turn off the lights, and if it's expressing that protein, but luciferase isn't quite as easy, but almost as easy. So again, we're trying to develop an assay where we can quantify or measure the response of our cells with these hormone receptors to certain compounds, samples, extracts. So we have ligand, binds to hormone receptor, goes to the response element that the hormone receptor recognizes, turns on expression of luciferase gene, which ultimately results in the protein, luciferase enzyme. We add a substrate to it that ultimately catalyzes a light reaction. So we get light levels. If we have a compound that's activating a hormone receptor, no activation, no light. Or no light above background anyway. You're always gonna have some light. Okay, sorry. So this is well and good, but we wanna be careful when we're treating our cells with these samples about what we're saying about a sample. So our cells, like Amy mentioned, metabolism. Our cells are perfectly capable of metabolizing a compound. So when we put a compound on and we get activity, we do not say that that compound gave activity because we don't know, just using this assay, if it was metabolized or not. So we want to be very careful about the mechanism and also calling the compound active. There are ways to measure if it was metabolized or not. So we want to talk about what happens when you put a sample on. We're talking about one compound, right? But what happens when you put a real environmental extract on? This is a chromatogram of not sediment or water or air, but it's actually of a seed extract. So has anyone heard of phytoestrogens here? Most everyone, genistein. This was a project I did for my master's. We were trying to identify why the seed kept giving us estrogenic activity on our estrogen bioassay. And so my job was, with no chemical background or training, was to go in and isolate the phytoestrogen. So this is messy, right? Every peak here is an individual compound, okay? So our bioassay by itself, if we put a sample on, cannot tell us anything about what is in that sample. All we know is that we have activity. But what we can do is pair our bioassay very nicely with separation chemistry. So don't pay too much attention, but a little bit of attention to this. So we have our seed extract up here. This is called bioassay directed fractionation. We have our seed extract, we know it gave activity on our bioassay. We go through a chemical separation. Here's our first set of fractions. We test all of them on the bioassay. The pluses indicate which ones gave light reading in our bioassay. We take those, do the chemistry on those, right? This is to save money and time. So then we combine, go through 44 fractions here. If we did not have the bioassay just for this step, we would have to do analytical chemistry on all 44 fractions. That's very, very expensive and time consuming and uses a lot of solvent. But with our bioassay, we've got three. Until ultimately, we get down to pure compounds here. And again, our bioassay does not tell us about toxicity, but rather what these cell lines do is they're really good scent hounds for getting on the trail. So it can lead us to maybe mechanistic studies. Oh, let's do the bioassay directed fractionation and then assess what those compounds can do. So I would like to acknowledge my advisor, Michael Dennison at UC Davis in the Environmental Toxicology Department, my undergraduate assistant, Arzu Basal, the Dennison Laboratory, and our funding sources. So if you do happen to run into your legislator, please tell them science needs funding. and thank you for listening. I'll take any questions.
I was curious, like, what would you say are the most likely endocrine-disrupting compounds that affect wildlife, and then what are the most likely kind of endocrine-disrupting compounds affecting humans?
Okay, wildlife, I would say birth control's a big one. Ethinyl estradiol, it's EE2, it's I forget if it's as potent or more potent than our natural E2, estradiol, 17-beta estradiol. A lot of chemical studies that are doing water analysis downstream of sewage treatment plants are finding active amounts of E2, levels of E2 capable of actually affecting fish. So I would say E2, birth control for like fish, amphibians, waterfowl. It's hard to say for humans. Bisphenol A is very hotly contested right now as far as exposure of infants and young children to this compound. Triclosan, I would not say there was called that it was an endocrine disruptor. This is found in like antibacterial liquid soaps. Also maybe the liquid gels, you could do that too. But I think that they're finding triclosan is not so much an endocrine disruptor, but it actually affects the ryanodine receptor?
Muscle contraction.
Right, so
hard to say,
I suppose.
So the word antibacterial soap went by pretty quickly. Are you suggesting it would be better not to have an antibacterial soap?
I'll tell you.
Well, I mean, I have, to say on that. I mean, my mother is actually a preschool teacher, and I advised her not to use soap with triclosan in it because she teaches four-year-olds. And I just, from what's coming out of UC Davis right now, especially on triclosan, it's better to avoid that compound. Antibacterial, I think they did a study like where they actually looked at what comes off your hands when you wash with regular soap and hot water, and that's no different or any better when you're using antibacterial soap. Soap is a lysis, pretty much, for bacteria, as far as I'm understanding. And because of the mixture of oil, or not oil, but water and the properties of the soap, it takes stuff off your hand. I don't know that regular soap's any worse than antibacterial at all. I don't think the studies are showing that it is. And then as far as like medical, like hospitals, that probably is important that surgeons do wash with antibacterial right before they go into surgery. At least that was what my surgeon too. But as far as everyday use, I don't use antibacterial soap. I use regular soap.
Can you speak about cosmetics a little bit? Because I'm pretty sure that the Europeans have much stricter regulations on cosmetics than the Americans do for a variety of reasons.
Well, I don't know about the regulations behind cosmetics. Any help here?
There are no, FDA does not. The Food and Drug Administration does not regulate what chemicals go in any products.
All those chemicals were grandfathered. I mean, chemicals were grandfathered, and where Europe did not take, the EU did not take that approach at all, grandfathering these chemicals. So, you know, I have two young daughters, and it's very concerning to me that you know, they're just.
Yeah, I personally try to avoid things with a lot of fragrance. I don't know. I mean, I try and buy like organic, but what does that mean? Is that any better? But what is concerning though is that in the U.S. we currently don't have regulations to take these compounds out of water coming out of wastewater treatment plants. It's not, in Europe, that's what made me think of it. It is a regulation, but not here currently. So hopefully that will become a concern for our legislature.
Yeah, there's a very strong lobby out there. And so the regulations for labeling cosmetics, personal care products, household cleaners don't exist. And whereas in Europe, they do exist. So there is concern.
Yeah.
Let's take one more question and then there's one more talk. So.
Does your scientific group correlate the slight preponderance of female births in the Western world with endocrine disruptors?
I think on the whole right now, so like the big ones, I mean, endocrine disruption is a growing field. Like I said, it's a lot more hormones than just estrogen or testosterone. But generally, it's thought of as the feminization of males or the masculinization of females. I'm not sure. I mean, that's interesting. It would correlate with what is seen in wildlife populations. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, because a lot of these compounds, when you say endocrine disruptions, they're usually estrogens. They're not androgens, so maybe exposing the prenatal at the right time to estrogens kind of can tend it towards female.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we have one more talk, and hopefully, I'll try not to talk really fast through this, but I do realize that we're running up on about 15 minutes. So I'm going to talk about how we exploit biology again, not using cell lines, but now proteins and actually antibody molecules. So antibodies are what we develop and produce on our own, but now we're manipulating biology so that we can produce these antibodies to small analytes that we're interested in, all these chemicals, these EDCs, endocrine disrupting compounds. So the trick is, what contaminants do we want to measure? A lot of these have already been mentioned. So bisphenol A, we know its structure. And one facet of this, my research, is that we have to know its structure to be able to develop an antibody to it. So we have lots of compounds. Oil spills, we know that that's made of polycyclic aramide hydrocarbons. We know it's structured. Pesticides, the DDT. Flame retardants in couch cushions and the upholstery that you're sitting on has flame retardants, brominated flame retardants, polybrominated diphenyl ethers. Or the personal care products that have triclosan in them. Those are all chemicals that we know the structure of, and therefore we can develop assays and tests to detect that molecule. But the contaminant themselves, this molecule itself, and all of those that I showed you, are not immunogenic. They do not elicit an immune response in our body on their own. So we have to make it immunogenic. So the way we do this is we use synthetic chemistry, and we attach a linking arm of some sort and some sort of functional group to bind it onto a large protein. And now we can covalently link it to a large protein. And if you recall, we do make antibodies to vaccines and to bacteria and viruses, and now this is the size of a bacteria. And so we can actually, depending on what protein molecule you use, but that is not immunogenic, but now we can make it immunogenic. So antibodies, as we've described, they are produced during what's called an adaptive immune response. So they're produced in all of us, they're produced in mammals and animals that we'll use. It's basically that they recognize large molecules, bacteria, protein, viruses, macromolecules. They are uniquely specific for their target, which means that when you get a vaccine to a specific measles or the influenza for this year, you're not vaccinated against influenza for next year, and they're specific to the target. And that's what makes this unique, that we can make it specific for the chemical that we want to detect. And what's really great is that our contaminant is the size of the epitope, the region that the antibody actually binds to. So the antibody is this Y-shaped molecule, and generally speaking, it will always be designated as this Y-shaped feature. And it recognizes the compounds, what binds in the binding pocket is the size of the contaminants that we're interested in. So this is how we can make antibodies to a small molecule. So the way we do it is we take that large macromolecule, and we can inject it into an animal. The lab mouse is a very common one. More recently, which is cutting edge science, is that we're using alpacas,
or camelids. Camels and alpacas have really unique antibodies, and we're exploiting them now. The sharks also do, but sharks are a little bit harder to contain. So we can boost them, we can basically give them a vaccine, inject them, we assess their titer, we essentially assess, are they actually detecting the compound we're interested in? And typically we do a couple of immunizations, and each time we assess whether or not they can actually produce antibodies to our molecule. And once we've determined they are producing antibodies to our target, we can then isolate the cells that they're secreting from. So antibodies are secreted from what are called B cells, or the white blood cells, and they're antibody-producing cells. So they're secreting antibodies into the bloodstream all day long, and you have a running titer of them all the time. But we don't have just one antibody-secreting cell. You're immunized to lots of things. You see lots of things on a daily basis. And so with the mouse and with all animals, we have what's called polyclonal antibodies, and that's what we're considered. We're considered that we have polyclonal in our body. But these, maybe this one recognizes influenza, maybe this recognizes something else, but what we want is the one that recognizes the small molecule that we're interested in, that analyte, that contaminant that we want to know. So with mice, about 40 years ago, there was a Nobel Prize awarded for the fact that they could actually take an immortal cell line, combine it with that one antibody-producing cell, and now you have a cell that can live endlessly in culture, can live endlessly, but it produces antibodies to the target of interest. And this is great because now for science, we have something that we don't have to continue sacrificing an animal. We can standardize it for regulatory purposes. We have a molecule that has a consistent binding site, and it's always going to recognize the analyte of interest. And that's what we term monoclonal antibodies. So mice, that was great 40 years ago, and it's still great now, but we still have to sacrifice an animal. Now we use alpacas. Alpacas also produce polyclonal antibodies, just like us. But what's unique is we can actually take the gene. We can isolate an antibody, the gene for the antibody in there, that they create, from isolating their gene. And then we can take that gene and inject it into, essentially into a virus. That virus then can infiltrate into a bacteria. The bacteria will secrete all of its, the virus's genome and secrete all of its protein, so that we have now, again, an endless supply of antibody, but we didn't have to sacrifice the animal, and we're just using a gene. And it's also monoclonal. But now we're just using the gene and not the whole animal. And so it's also novel. It's been created the last 5 years. And so the alpacas are fun. And we're at UC Davis, and they have an alpaca farm and a large animal facility, so we have access to them. All right, so now we have all these antibodies, but what can we do with them? You're probably familiar with the pregnancy test. This is a most commonly known antibody-based test. And the way it works is that you have antibodies that are directed towards, in this case, a large protein, the HCG, the hormone produced when women are pregnant, but it's secreted in their urine. And so when a woman is pregnant and she puts a sample of her urine that contains this protein on what's called a test strip, on this lateral flow paper device, the antibodies are already loaded onto the device when you buy it. They bind to the antibody if the sample has the protein, and if they do, they will stay in this region and bind and produce a band. If there is no protein present, just the antibody will bind at the second line. And so, of course, if you have no green proteins here, you will have no line, and therefore you're not pregnant. But if you have two lines, that means you are pregnant. And so this is based on antibody technology, the same technology that we're using to detect small molecules. So what we hope to use it for, what I will show you, is that we're using it to monitor environmental contaminants. The goal being, here's our contaminant, here is whatever sample we have, and there's our antibody, and it has some sort of tag, some sort of way of saying we bound and we are interacting with our compound if it's interacting. And so the goal is just introduce the sample with the antibody, and we get a signal. So one way I use this is for my PhD work developing what's called a biosensor. So that's simply just that a biological reagent, this antibody, is mixed with this electrochemical or electric sensor unit. So what we've done, it has reagent reservoirs, so that we can stick reagents and leave them there. It can be automated so that we can set up and hit go and walk away. It has precise fluidics so that we're always measuring the same volume, which makes this very quantitative as opposed to the yes-no qualitative. Now we can actually measure concentration. And of course, it has the band by small, not to scale here. And we can detect it with the, so we have a fluorescent tag on our antibody. We can detect it with this fluorescent light on the sensor. And I've worked with a company called Sapodyne. So the way I've used this biosensor was monitoring an estuary in the Elizabeth River, which is part of the Chesapeake Bay. So I did my research out in Virginia, but essentially they have years of creosote pollution. So creosote contains polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and that's what I made an antibody to. And in this river, in this estuary, here is where contaminated sediments reside. And the Elizabeth River Project wanted to remediate this site. They want to dredge up all of those pH contaminated sediments, move them off site. But when they dredge it up, they're going to be liberating all these chemicals right into the water column. And so what they wanted to know is, will they be released? So they also put up a curtain here, this dredge curtain, to knock down any sediment that would be going past it, past the curtain. And they wanted to know how far up and down the stream, up and down this river, are the contaminants getting measured? How high is their pollution spreading during the dredging? And standard techniques, standard traditional analytical methods, would take weeks and days to bring back a sample from the field and test it. And yeah, so there we are on site. Oh, and then pHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, at this site, Money Point, are recorded at some of the highest levels in any waterway in the world. And they are most commonly known for cancer, and definitely with these bottom-dwelling fish here. So there we are, that's me on a boat with my biosensor, on this boat right there, on the water, taking real-time samples. So here are our results. So here you can see the dredge, and the size of the circle is correlates with the concentration that we're finding in the river. And what we see is that the concentrations are very low. For this site, being at micrograms per liter, which is parts per billion, is actually, it's almost background. This is really background levels. And that is not of environmental concern. We also were able to report these concentrations to the managers on site in real time and tell them that we didn't have to go miles up and down the river. We only had to go a few meters, and the concentration started to drop off. And they also predicted, so when we took a sample and we ran it, we knew where to take the next sample. And so we didn't have to go very far. And so this was really a great demonstration of being able to use the science to tell us what to do next. Another one that we've used in an antibody-based method was measuring triclocarban, a compound that's found in bar soaps. And it's also antimicrobial. And we detected it. So it also may, triclocarban may or may not, it's undecided still, alter the action of hormones, but of course we are very closely regulated to hormones, and so we don't want exogenous compounds from our environment, actually playing a role in our hormone system. So that's why we're measuring and why triclocarban is on our list of a chemical that we monitor. But here you can see that urine concentration, so the goal of any compound that we get in our body is to excrete it, as everybody has mentioned. So the goal is here to, we wanted to measure the triclocarban concentrations, but as you'd expect in urine, they'd spike at some point after the shower and then drop off. And so here you can see every individual responds differently. It depends on how often you use it. They did have this, they did require every person in the study to shower for 10 minutes, so then that was normalized. So that's an example of using an amino assay, an antibody-based test, to detect a compound of interest in urine. And this can't be done that well with analytical methods because all these samples, there's a ton of them in that short amount of time. And to extract them and then run them is costly and time prohibitive. Lengthy time. So, okay. But where can we find information about all these chemicals and what compounds are in our products, our personal care products? So these are just four brands that if you search triclocarban in the household products database funded by the government that they hold up, this database will tell you that these compounds antibacterial soap, and it's always bar soap for triclocarban, liquid soap for triclosan, but you can find the information at this website, and you can plug in formaldehyde or perfluorinated compounds. You can put in a lot of different ingredients, and as long as it's a household product, you can get information as to if it's in there. With that, I'd like to thank everybody who's contributed to my research and to the Environmental Research Center for hosting us tonight. We can all take questions, but
can you go back and so we can get on the
oh, sure.
Site?
Thank you.
Alan?
Yes, sir.
So, is it at some point in the future, I guess there's a plan to make some of these products immunogenic at their sources, or make humans immunogenic? Is that no. possible?
We cannot. So that would not be. Well, we don't want us to react to them. That may be a reason why a lot of people have a higher peanut allergy nowadays, is because we have been having what's called these adducts, the chemical binding to a protein and becoming immunogenic. So we don't want our bodies to respond to them. That's not an option. And the first one was, what was the first part of that?
I have something separate. I actually just read about this app that you can find that's called Think Dirty, Shop Clean.
So I've had
research
views
on it.
You
have.
Yep, Think Dirty is an app where you can scan products and the barcode will tell you. Another website that I really like, but it's not the government funded one, is EWG, Environmental Working Group. They're having an app come out in the fall that's called Skin Deep. And that app will also, and I think that Think Dirty uses the EWG database. And what I like about the EWG database is that it tells you, based on the concentrations of a compound in the product, how potentially harmful it is. And they do have a scale of 7 and 9 being really bad, and water being great. And it's a good resource.
Does the EWG pick which products are on that website? Because I've looked stuff up before by certain company, and none of their products are listed.
I do not know how they select.
I don't know.
First of all, I think it's great to see three women doing such great research. Second of all, I'm wondering if any of you are either Girl Scouts or Girl Guides.
What was the second one?
Girl Scouts or Girl Guides.
Girl Guides.
I was a Girl Scout.
A Girl Scout, okay. Yeah.
Then you still are.
I was a Brownie, but I don't know.
Yes?
I mean, 20 years ago when I worked in wastewater, we didn't test for any of these. Are you currently?
They are. So triclosan is showing up really, really high in wastewater effluent. And they are testing for it now. Caffeine also shows up really high. I don't know about all of the management plans as to if they're mandated to test for them. But we are finding, and flame retardants are actually showing up really high in wastewater effluent because it's not treated by chlorinating it. It's not treated by bacterial degradation. And so it is just going through the system, and those are compounds that may be contributing to early puberty and endocrine disrupting.
Is there a way to treat that?
Carbon is the...
Or maybe certain bacteria can or make it inactive.
So one way your Brita filter works is by having a carbon filter, and often light will dissolve light, and these are a lot of hydrophobic compounds, and they'll sorb onto the carbon. But that is a costly venture to have all the wastewater effluent run through a carbon filter. So I don't know of any great technologies yet. We are working on some in our nanotechnology part of remediation of Superfund to clean up metals with nanotechnology. But that's a totally different topic. We can talk about it later if you'd like. Yes?
Does non-BPA plastic water bottles also have an estrogenic effect?
Apparently, it depends. The
my advisor's actually, I probably shouldn't say he's involved in a law, well, he's not in a lawsuit, but there was a law, a jury case, actually, about the, I won't say the company, but they replaced BPA with three other resins, and apparently, as a whole, the resin does give activity in our cell line, but the company is claiming it has no estrogenic activity. So it's just, yeah, it, when you take something out like that, you wanna do the proper testing with the replacement to make sure you're not replacing it with just as bad or worse. So, and that's not, I'm not saying all BPA-free bottles are that, it's just this one company, that was their solution. So, yeah, but it's a good point.
In Jennifer's talk, you were talking about bioassays, and so you were taking some of the compounds, and if I understand it properly, then you're using some kind of biological, like a nuclear extract or a cell extract to maybe metabolize and then look at the intermediates, or what are the bioassay of your assay?
Well, the bio is we use mammalian carcinoma cell lines, so that's the bio.
And so you're assuming they're metabolizing?
Well, we're not. We don't know. There is a way to do that. If you find, with our assay, it's a specific tissue and it's a specific cell type within that tissue even. So there are limitations. Generally, hormone receptors tend to act the same though, regardless of the tissue. So if you find that one cell, this compound's active, and another cell, it's not, you might think, well, either that cell doesn't have a receptor for it, or there's something else going on. And in one of those cases, it could be metabolism. One cell might be capable of metabolizing the compound to either an inactive form or an active form. And they actually did a neat experiment with, I think it was mouse versus human. And the mouse, one compound was not giving activity in the human, it was. So they actually took the liquid off the human cells, put it on the mouse cells, and saw that now the mouse cell is giving activity. And when they went through that bioassay-directed process that I talked about with that media, they actually found out what the metabolite was. The compound was getting metabolized to an active form in one of the cells, but the other cell was not capable of doing that by itself. But yeah, so there's a lot of, and again, just with toxicity, these are cells, so we're not talking about what happens in the whole animal, but it is a really good pointer for a screen for samples of concern, compounds of concern that we want to study further.
Since BPA has come up a few times, can one of you explain why it would be that BPA has been placed in cash register tapes, for example? What is the feature of BPA?
I think it's a really good plasticizer it's just a really good plasticizer, I believe. I mean, maybe it keeps maybe there's flexibility and strength. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it keeps the plastic from shattering.
Well, it's cash register tape.
Oh. Yeah, it was like, I know one of the grocery stores in our town right now states that their receipts are BPA free. So apparently, I guess all grocery store receipts have BPA or had BPA in them.
Yeah,
but BPA is a very interesting one. It is very hotly contested because just through the classical estrogen receptor mechanism, it's pretty weak. It's not that potent. But with estrogen receptor, they're finding more pathways than just the classic pathway. And apparently BPA may be rather potent through those alternative pathways, still turning on the same set of genes that the classical pathway might do. So there's a lot of study going around BPA right now.
I think once they find a chemical that's good for a lot of things, it also can be bound up as a chain of molecules, and it's effective at being can liners and plastic and being a soft, malleable plastic. It just gets everywhere, and it's persistent.
The concern with children who and infants being exposed to an estrogen-like compound at that time in their life can have effects later on, or at least it's been shown in laboratory studies and seen in wildlife.
All right, well, if there are any other questions, I'm sure you're willing to stick around for a little bit longer, but let's give them all a round of applause.